It is Friday, October the 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, President Obama changes his mind about keeping U.S. troops in Afghanistan.
What has happened is that the situation on the ground in Afghanistan has become so dangerous and so serious that for Obama, he has had to set aside his legacy considerations.
Also ahead, some suggest accepting the influx of refugees, not resisting it, plus the American Music Awards. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. At the White House on Thursday, President Obama said he will adjust the planned withdrawal of American military forces from Afghanistan, scheduled for next year, as the Taliban makes gains there that the U.S. was not anticipating.
As Commander-in-Chief, I will not allow Afghanistan to be used as safe haven for terrorists to attack our nation again. Our forces therefore remain engaged in two narrow but critical missions: training Afghan forces and supporting counterterrorism operations against the remnants of Al-Qaeda.
Mr. Obama said he will maintain the current number of troops in Afghanistan at 9,800 through most of 2016. And at the Pentagon on Thursday, Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter talked about the drawdown of U.S. troops.
By January 2017, U.S. forces will draw down to 5,500 troops, and they will be deployed at several locations around Afghanistan, including Kabul, Bagram, Kandahar, and Jalalabad, in support of two important and enduring missions: our counterterrorism effort and our train, advise, and assist support to the Afghan security forces.
And now for some analysis of the U.S. announcement about keeping troops in Afghanistan, VOA's Mohammed Ikram speaks via Skype with Michael Kugelman at the Washington Wilson Center.
I think that President Obama, for a very long time, wanted to remove every U.S. troop from Afghanistan on his watch. But I think what has happened is that the situation on the ground in Afghanistan has become so dangerous and so serious that for Obama, he has had to set aside his legacy considerations due to the very troubling situation on the ground in Afghanistan. I think that the U.S. government has been increasingly concerned about the rising influence of the ISIS terror group in Afghanistan. And so I think that there was already momentum to keep U.S. troops in Afghanistan for quite some time. But now, with the Kunduz seizure some time ago, I think that has essentially reinforced the view of the United States that Afghan forces are simply not in the position to take full control of security and to ensure stability, given what has become a double threat of the Taliban and ISIS.
There is a debate in the region people are talking about, that is it the best way to address the security situation in Afghanistan by keeping troops in Afghanistan, the American troops? What they say at the end of the day, Afghanistan has to take its affairs into its own hands. But how do you see that? Is it the best option, or what needs to be done to keep Afghanistan stable?
Well, I mean, I'll be honest, that keeping U.S. troops in Afghanistan does not ensure that the insurgency will end. As you say, many things must happen that have nothing to do with U.S. troops in order for the insurgency to end. The Afghanistan government must come up with a much stronger plan to deal with the insurgency. And also the sanctuaries for the Taliban in Pakistan need to be eliminated. So long as they remain, the insurgency will remain strong. But I do think that having U.S. troops in Afghanistan, even if only a few thousand, can be a big psychological boost for the Afghan security forces. I think they will be reassured, and it could raise morale if they know that the United States and that the U.S. military is not abandoning them. So I think that is the best reason to have them there. I mean, they certainly can provide important training and advising roles. They can help try to fill gaps in the capacities of Afghan security forces by trying to train the Afghans better and doing things like intelligence collection, providing air cover, and so forth. But the biggest benefit of a continued U.S. troop presence in Afghanistan is the morale boost and the psychological lift that it will provide for Afghan forces.
Michael Kugelman is a Wilson Center scholar. He was speaking via Skype with VOA's Mohammed Ikram. And we turn now to what's being said online about the president's announcement. As always, our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, is here with the latest. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve.
Did the White House tweet about this?
It sure did. The White House shared a video clip of President Obama's statement on the issue. That video clip is the most popular tweet from the account Thursday, with around 400 people sharing and marking it as a favorite, respectively. The second most shared tweet from that account reads like this: "May God bless our troops and all who keep us safe. And may God continue to bless the United States of America, at POTUS. The White House is on Twitter, at White House."
And what's the reaction from press accounts?
A lot of analytical pieces. The New York Times tweeted a link to an article by Peter Baker, who is on Twitter, at PeterBakerNYT. He tweeted, "Looking for a different outcome than in Iraq, Obama opts for a different approach in Afghanistan." Baker argued, "Afghanistan is more directly tied to American interests than Iraq or Syria because it was a base for al-Qaeda planning the 9/11 attack."
And what were we hearing outside of Twitter?
For that, let's move on to our website. VOA's White House correspondent Aru Panda's article getting pretty good traffic. It's titled, "Obama Slows U.S. Troop Withdrawal from Afghanistan."
And do we have any reader comments at voanews.com on this story?
Absolutely. Here's one from Kenya. "It was a big mistake for American troops to go to Afghanistan. It's now very dangerous for them to withdraw. The region is just volatile." Another reader from Brazil wrote this: "I am sure that President Obama would like to keep his promise and withdraw American troops from Afghanistan. However, the situation has changed and the withdrawal will increase terrorism in the region. As absurd as it sounds, Afghanistan and Syria need strong leaders to stabilize the political and economic situation. The concepts of freedom and democracy will have to wait." Steve?
And thanks very much, G. That is International Edition's social media guru, G. Abby Lee. She tweets for our VOA International Edition Twitter account at VOA_IE. And as always, you can follow her on her own Twitter account at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
"This is a problem that inflicts almost every country."
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Balkan countries are a transit route for thousands of refugees, most of them Syrians, who are fleeing violence and trying to find a better life in the economically advanced countries of the European Union. Experts say there is still no solution for the refugee crisis because the European Union has yet to adopt a comprehensive strategy to deal with the influx of hundreds of thousands of refugees. VOA's Gianni Bosieski has more.
This is a picture of daily life at the Macedonian-Serbian border. Tens of thousands of migrants of all ages have arrived. Many are ill or injured. Their immediate needs are clear: shelter, food, medical care. Most are Syrians. Europe must respond to the migrants in a more cohesive way. says Michel Gaboudan, president of Refugees International.
The European borders must remain open to people who seek protection. Now, I know that in the movement there are people who are not refugees and they need to be screened out. But let's not forget the majority of them, we have these from the UN, etc., do come from Syria, do come from Iraq, do come from Afghanistan. Most of them would qualify as refugees.
Reka Semerkeni, Hungary's ambassador to the United States, says the main problems are traffickers who are making money on human suffering. Hungary was the first European Union member to increase border security measures and was accused of treating the refugees harshly. But Semerkeni says the government has a responsibility to protect the common European border.
At the same time, we understand that those countries that have taken the largest part of the burden, Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, where the largest numbers of refugees are in camps, we have to provide for them and we have to help them also to be able to support those people who are there.
Johns Hopkins University professor Daniel Server says the best way to deal with the refugee crisis is to stop the flow of people out of Syria and Afghanistan. But he acknowledges there is no quick solution.
The refugees have found a path. That path may be closed here or closed there, but one way or another they will find their way to those countries that are willing to accept them. Fortunately, Europe needs some of these young, educated workers. So I think Europe just has to get used to doing something that America got used to a long time ago, which is accepting immigration, not resisting it.
Many European countries face aging, declining populations, like Server Christian Odenhall of the Center for European Reforms says the migrants could help ease the brain drain of young professionals from the Balkans and Europe.
The refugee crisis, of course, poses a challenge, but also it has the potential to help Europe or parts of Europe solve their demographic problems. It depends on to the extent to which Europeans will be able to integrate migrants, particularly into the labor markets.
Germany expects up to 1 million asylum seekers this year alone. And the world's seven leading industrialized countries, along with the Gulf states, have pledged $1.8 billion to help with the migrant crisis. But life at the border crossing for many migrants moving across the Balkans towards Europe is still anything but easy. Jane Bojagievski, VOA News.
European leaders dealing with the ongoing migrant and refugee crisis could learn some lessons from South Africa. South Africa faced its own migrant and asylum seeker crisis in recent years when many Zimbabweans fled their homeland during an economic downturn. There were massive bureaucratic problems as a result, as well as xenophobic violence. Lauren Landau is a researcher with the African Center for Migration and Society at the University of Witwatersrand. From Johannesburg now, he speaks to VOA's Joe DeCapua about what can be done to help ease the European crisis.
Well, I think when we look at what's happening in Europe now, and it's been happening really for months, we do start to see immediate comparisons of a sort of fearful public who's facing, in some instances, an economic crisis, and a government response which is confused and mixed with a kind of humanitarian impulse, but also a deep economic and physical security impulse. And our question is, okay, well, South Africa has been dealing with the same thing for a long time, and what could we learn from that?
What were the biggest problems South Africa faced with the influx from Zimbabwe?
South Africa, in some ways, faced very few problems at a kind of economic level. Zimbabweans came in, many found jobs, and many were able to contribute, but there was a perception problem, which is, I think, also what's driving the response in Europe, a sense that foreigners were bringing crime, foreigners were bringing disease, foreigners were likely to affect local cultures, and certainly foreigners were going to take away jobs. And as a result, what we saw was a very strong anti-foreigner response from the government and even stronger, sometimes violent response from local politicians and citizens.
I remember there were some bureaucratic nightmares as well as the xenophobic violence. Do you foresee that happening on a wide scale in Europe?
Well, what we've seen in South Africa, and I think what we're already starting to see in Europe, is a underground economy for documents. When you try to give one small group of people legal rights and exclude everyone else, you create a scarce resource that has enormous value. And what we've seen in South Africa is deep-seated corruption emerge around refugee documents. And I think we've started to see some of this already happening as Europe has sought to control the influx of people into its territory.
You mentioned this in your article on the problems in South Africa. We're seeing it in Europe. You have the asylum seekers, the economic migrants, and now a new class called climate migrants who are fleeing areas affected by climate change. Is there a problem when you have so many divisions?
Well, I think what we're seeing is an effort to try to categorize complex phenomena, which mix environment, mix politics, mix economics, into neat bureaucratic categories. That might have worked in the past. I'm not sure that it ever worked very well. But increasingly, it's difficult to differentiate those populations, and states are struggling to do so. And unfortunately, they haven't yet found a way of thinking about this in slightly different ways.
So what did South Africa do right after several years of facing this problem to sort of calm the situation?
Well, I think South Africa continues to be in a deep-seated crisis around migration. There's been increased raids on police, moves on behalf of politicians to try to take away the rights of refugees and also to exclude new migrants. There are some people in civil society who have been saying, look, migration is natural. We need the skills. We need the resources. We need the trade. But those voices are often being drowned out by groups who say we must protect our rights, we must protect our cultures and our economy.
That's Lauren Landau, researcher at the African Center for Migration and Society at the University of Witwatersrand. He was speaking with VOA's Joe DiCapua. Well, you know, Thursday was World Hand Washing Day. It was 7 years ago that health campaigners, including UNICEF and the U.S. Agency for International Development, decided that October 15th would be the day that we celebrate hand washing and remind ourselves of its health benefits. Nick Long reports now on a hand-washing campaign in the eastern DRC city of Goma.
A song blares out from a truck trailer in Goma. Aimed at mothers, it tells them to wash their hands with soap at five key moments: before cooking, before giving food to their children, before eating, after going to the bathroom, and after cleaning their children. And if they don't have soap, they can also use ashes. A popular comedian here, Jazza Jazza, leads the campaign from the trailer, singing, dancing and dispensing health advice. There's no connection between your children teething and diarrhea, he tells parents. No, Mama, it's the dirt under your fingernails. The American aid organization Mercy Corps says a recent survey found less than a third of the population here wash their hands at all the five moments, including before giving food to their children, for example. And few people use soap at all the five moments. I know many of you have toilets, says Jazza Jazza, but if I offered you $20, I bet you couldn't show me a toilet with soap next to it. A Mercy Corps survey found there are several obstacles to hand washing besides lack of access to water. Many people said they simply forget or it's not in their culture. But water access is a major problem in Goma, where the water utilities network was wrecked by a volcanic eruption in 2002. Recently, Mercy Corps put in 52 tap stands around town. The price of water at those stands is equivalent to about 5 US cents per 20 litres, compared with 30 or 40 US cents that truck and motorbike water vendors were charging. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
And you can get more on Nick's story and the rest of the day's news at our website, voanews.com. And now we turn to what's being said about the Roman Catholic Church and some of the scandals of late. Here's International Edition's Susan Yaki.
Pope Francis has offered a rare, if vague, apology for scandals involving the Roman Catholic Church after several high-profile gaffes that were linked to the church or its clergy. Speaking in Rome at the beginning of his weekly general audience, Pope Francis said he asks forgiveness in the name of the church for the scandals that have recently hit Rome and the Vatican. He did not offer details. The Pope's comments drew applause, but also confusion about what he was referring to. A VOA religion correspondent, Jerome Sokolovsky, joins us here. Welcome, Jerome.
Happy to be here, Susan.
Thank you. What scandals might the Pope be referring to?
Nobody really knows. There's been some speculation that it's been about a priest who came out as gay and criticized the church's approach to same-sex marriage. Another possibility is planning for the church's jubilee, upcoming jubilee year, has been mired in some difficulties.
What kind of difficulties?
Just the planning hasn't gone very well. And some people are also saying the Pope was talking about the mayor of Rome, who recently resigned because and criticized that he took a trip to Philadelphia during the Pope's visit to the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Well, this apology, it seems quite unusual.
It's unusual partly because now we're in the midst of the Synod on the Family, where hundreds of prelates have gathered in Rome and are talking about the church's approach to family issues. They're said to be progressives who want that to change, or certainly want the approach to change. And there was a letter written by conservatives accusing progressives of trying to more or less hijack the meeting.
What is the church's position on families in general? I know it's a huge subject, but can you give me an idea of where they stand?
Well, the two main issues are rejecting and homosexuality and same-sex marriage, open homosexuality, that is. The church is okay if you're homosexual and don't practice it. And the other is toward divorce, toward divorced and remarried Catholics, whether they should be allowed to take communion or not.
Well, you know, this Pope is kind of very unique, don't you think?
He certainly, I would say he's not so unique on church doctrine. He's supported it up till now. He's not said that's changing at all. But he certainly has changed the approach of the church, the style, and wants a more kind of evangelical Christian type of approach where the clergy and leaders are out in the streets, you know, with the people. He talks about a church of the poor, a church of, you know, of the slums, really.
That's VOA religion correspondent Jerome Sokolowski speaking with my colleague Susan Yockey. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
As of October 1st, 2015, smoking in cars while children are present has been banned in the United Kingdom. Other European countries may soon follow suit. Researchers at Newcastle University say the results of their new study show that smoke toxicity levels can rise dramatically inside a car in just a short time. Lead researcher Anil Nandeo.
The peak level a child exposed to. And we found that this peak could be up to 100 times higher than the safe recommended limits.
Namdeo adds that he considers that no level of smoke inside a car is safe for a child. Jo Harding is pregnant and pleased that her child won't have to breathe in secondhand smoke.
I don't want to be exposed to it as a pregnant person, but I don't want to expose to it as a non-pregnant person either.
Researchers say that the still developing respiratory systems and brains of children are especially susceptible to the effects of tobacco smoke. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, the nominations for the 2015 American Music Awards have been announced, and VOA's Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong joining International Edition's Sarah Williams to talk about the country music nominees.
Awards season is upon us, and the Country Music Association Awards released their nominees about a month back. And just this week, the American Music Association announced their selection. VOA Music's Nikki Strong is here to weigh in on how country music fared. Well, Nikki, were there any surprises for country music in particular at the AMAs this year?
Yes, there were surprises. So aside from the basic country music categories like favorite male and female country artist of the year, country music had nominees in two other coveted categories, which was Artist of the Year and New Artist of the Year. Luke Bryan was nominated again this year for Artist of the Year, and Sam Hunt, who has the most, he's the country artist with the most nominations, he is up for New Artist of the Year. And last year, the AMAs did not have any country artist in that category. So I think it really speaks to his crossover appeal and success he's had this year.
Well, what do you think are the chances for Sam Hunt or Luke Bryan to win in either of those categories?
Well, the AMAs are determined by online voting. So right now there are 10 nominees for Artist of the Year, and that's going to be narrowed down to 5 on November 11th based on fan votes. So Luke Bryan was in the final list last year. Hopefully he will make it again this year. He's up against Taylor Swift, Ed Sheeran, Nicki Minaj, Sam Smith, to name a few, and they have ferocious social media followings. We all know how popular Taylor Swift is.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. And as far as Sam Hunt is concerned, like Luke Bryan, he has some pretty stiff competition. So he's going up against The Weeknd, who has made history on the charts, as well as the very popular group Walk the Moon and Tove Lo. So like Luke Bryan, his fans are really going to have to show up and vote, especially in light of The Weeknd's tremendous success this year.
Any word or rumor as to which country artists will be performing?
Ah, not yet. Last year, Luke Bryan introduced Garth Brooks live from Garth's concert in North Carolina. And so will Sam Hunt or Carrie Underwood or even Blake Shelton introduce someone else? That has yet to be seen.
When do the AMAs air and where can people vote?
Well, November 22nd, it airs live on the ABC network and people can vote at amavote.com. I already voted.
Okay. You got that message out there, so make sure you vote.
Yes.
Well, you can reach Nikki Strong on Twitter at @VOA_music or on Facebook at simply VOA Music. You can also catch Nikki Strong on Country Hits USA on VOA 1. Thanks very much, Nikki.
Thank you. Have a good time. I'm going to bring the good time home to you. We'll have a
It's the song House Party by 30-year-old singer-songwriter Sam Hunt. If you don't know about him, he's quite a guy. Grew up in rural Georgia. He even was a gifted athlete. Ended up being a quarterback at a couple of colleges. Quite a guy. Hey, listen, everyone. Thanks for joining us today right here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead, so you should stay tuned. You'll get all the latest of what's happening all over the world. And for our director right now, Tracy Carter, great guy. Engineer Jim Harmon, a good guy himself. I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Hope you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
The 22nd Amendment to the United States Constitution, ratified in 1951, states that no person shall be elected to the office of the president more than twice, and no person who has held the office of president or acted as president for more than 2 years of a term to which some other person was elected president shall be elected to the office of the president more than once. The amendment resolved an issue that Americans had debated since the founding of the Republic. Should there be a limit on the number of terms any individual can serve as President of the United States? The U.S. Constitution, as adopted in 1789, set no term limits for the office of the President. But many Americans feared that a popular leader, if continually reelected, might become corrupt or oppressive. Thomas Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence, was troubled by the Constitution's omission of term limits. The feature I dislike, he wrote, and greatly dislike, is the abandonment in every instance of the necessity of rotation in office, and most particularly in the case of the president. America's first president, George Washington, chose to limit his time in office to 2 terms. A precedent followed until the election of Franklin D. Roosevelt to a 3rd term in 1940 and a 4th term in 1944. His death in 1945, early in his 4th term, reignited the debate about the ability of persons continually reelected to the presidency to serve effectively. As President Barack Obama noted in his address at the African Union in July, South Africa's Nelson Mandela and America's George Washington forged a lasting legacy, not only because of what they did in office, but because they were willing to leave office and transfer power peacefully.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
For